Welcome to Dispatches with Diwa, the monthly episode of the Dispatches podcast where we talk with political commentator Diwa de Boer about exactly what is going on in the world of New Zealand politics, and we discuss and dissect everything that's trending globally as well. Diwa de Boer is a political commentator who runs conservative think tank Right Minds New Zealand. He also writes a column for the BFD, and he has a Friday morning radio show on Reality Check Radio. He advocates for a return to tradition, is optimistic about the future, and he lives in Auckland with his wife and their three kids. So without any further ado, let's get into this episode of Dispatches with Diwa. Diwa, welcome back to another episode. It's good to have you back on again, my friend.
And it is good to be back, as always. I enjoy our chats, and I enjoy being on the other end of the microphone. Usually I'm the one asking questions these days. It's great to have someone who I can give answers to.
The more torturous end. What I'm going to do today is I'm actually just, our listeners can't see this. No, I don't know why I'm holding it up. But I've just set my iPhone with a timer. We are going to really be strict tonight. I'm gonna make sure that your lovely wife is not punished any more than she needs to, being married to such a celebrity and an insightful one as yourself. And also, we do want to get the most out of tonight because you're away next month, aren't you?
That's right. I've got a long-planned holiday with Amy. This year is our 10th wedding anniversary. We celebrated that a few months ago. And also, she turned 30 this year. I'm turning 30 in February. So we wanted to take a good time off together and get away from everyone and everything. So that's scheduled in for next month.
Alrighty, let's jump into it then, Diwa. No more wasting of time. The Common Grace Group here in New Zealand, calling themselves Common Grace Aotearoa, a group, and they put out an open letter, and then they have 440, I think it was, up to Christian leaders, some who are retired, to be fair, who signed this open letter, basically urging all parliamentarians to act to prevent a bill, the Treaty Principles Bill, from actually even going to the first reading. What do you make of this?
The most amazing part is that they hadn't read the bill yet when they sent the letter. So they're very concerned about this divisive bill being put forward and all of the problems that it was going to cause, and it hadn't been released yet. Obviously, we know what it looks like now, so we shall have to wait and see what they follow up with. But it certainly shows the political nature of a lot of what you might refer to as progressive Christianity. It's a group that's very concerned about social justice, or what we might call the social gospel, which seems to be mostly a 20th century heresy, if I may call it that, where there's a concern about people's material well-being and social justice and social standing and equity, but they're not really concerned about morality and Christian theology and Christian orthodoxy, and that leads them to be completely silent when it comes to moral issues. And then when it comes to these progressive political issues, then they're willing to stand up. Then they get offended.
Tell me a little bit about the history too, because before the show we were talking about this, and you were wondering where they actually got the wherewithal to call themselves Common Grace, because it actually has a Calvinist history, doesn't it?
Yes. So the term Common Grace was coined by a Dutch theologian, and he was the Prime Minister of the Netherlands in the early 1900s. His name is Abraham Kuyper, and he was known as a neo-Calvinist. He was quite an interesting character in terms of his theology and political standing in the Netherlands. And he wrote a book, or a series of books, but one of these books was called Common Grace. And it was the idea that God did not only have grace on the elect, the Christians who are saved, and it's not just saving grace that God has, but he also has a common grace to all men that he provides us with and watches over all of mankind at some level. And obviously you can find that concept spread throughout the Bible. Even the heathens have some level of common grace that they've been given. That's the origin of the term at the turn of the century, or turn of last century.
I'm assuming you know a little bit more about the man. I don't know my Calvinist history because I'm not a Calvinist, but how do you think he'd fit into this group?
I don't think he would fit into this group very well, actually. Okay. He's known for being very, very conservative. I think he ran one of the last Christian governments in the Netherlands. He did some work to bring Calvinists and Roman Catholics together in the Netherlands, and he founded the Anti-Revolutionary Party. So he was staunchly opposed to the French Revolution, and that's what the political party was named after, its opposition to the French Revolution, the Anti-Revolutionary Party. And you'll see that most of his, political descendants, if we may call them that, are, say, the Christian Democratic parties in Europe. And they do sort of embrace these ideas that we see from Common Grace Aotearoa. So I wonder if it's just a kind of a degradation of his political ideas in the last 100 years. Not his ideas, but the inheritors of his ideas and what they've done with them.
So borrow something and what do we call it? Cultural appropriation, I think, don't we?
That's right.
A sin. That's a cardinal sin.
But unfortunately, the anti-revolutionaries lost, and of course, we see that in the entire political world today. It's all liberalism. Everything is liberalism.
That's right. All of your cultures belong to us now, and we will tell you when you are a sinner and when you are not. It's interesting. I did a podcast episode about it, and those who are listening today on Friday, I've actually been asked if I could make it freely available. So I'm going to do that tomorrow on Saturday. The patrons have had it for a few days already. I put it out on Tuesday and I share my thoughts in there. But I kind of feel, it was a bit of a damp squid. It turned out to be anyway, because Seymour has actually negotiated himself a full, 6 months or something, hasn't he, of the process of this. So it's going to be discussed now and in a lot of detail. But also the fact now that there's sort of great risk here that effectively, if the bill doesn't seem to actually fit the bill that they've described it as being, then it sort of ruins or undermines their reputation in the public square, doesn't it? It sort of makes it look like they went off half-cocked or they were being dishonest. I don't think they were being dishonest, but I suspect they didn't really discern well what they were responding to.
No. As we've seen with the actual bill now that it's come out and the principles behind it, it's actually a lot stronger in terms of recognizing the Treaty of Waitangi, the rights that it grants specifically to iwi and hapu, to the point where I wonder if, say, Hobson's Pledge will come out against the bill or something like that, like that.
Wouldn't that be just hilarious irony?
But I think it's an improvement. I thought the whole thing was going to be, as David Seymour was selling it and as the principles that they had put forward, that the ACT Party had suggested, it was just liberalism, right? It was like, okay, let's take the treaty and let's take the ideas that the missionaries put forward, and when they refer to this as the Magna Carta of the Aborigines of New Zealand, which is Henry Williams, and he was supposed to be their Magna Carta, their Charter of Rights, and he's sort of taken that to the next level. David Seymour was going to take that into the 21st century, and it was going to be a universal declaration of rights and have no real historical context anymore, in terms of how we should deal with it today. And I think Hobson's Pledge was very happy with that, and there are plenty of people I know who don't want anything to do with the treaty. They just want the treaty gone in terms of its relevance to New Zealand today. But what you see in the principles is it actually says that iwi and hapu have the right to, to their collective self-determination, and they can negotiate with the crown, and that if there are laws that give them special treatment, then that's perfectly fine. That's one of the principles of the treaty, which, like I say, is more accurate in my opinion. And it seems to be, though, the complete opposite of what David Seymour was initially aiming for.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It might be that they have rather astutely figured out and read the waters. I mean, especially when you've got people telegraphing in advance what they're claiming the bill's going to be, and that gives you the advantages, the crafters of the bill, when it hasn't even appeared yet, to actually reshape the bill. But effectively, it gives you a bit of a political advantage to say either, oh, look, it's not as bad as they're claiming, or B, you say, look, I'm not an extremist. I've listened to the people.
Well, David Seymour, he's an excellent political operator, as much as I dislike his politics personally. He is an excellent political operator, and he has basically taken this, that I'm willing to compromise, I'm willing to listen to you. I've taken on board all of the feedback that people have been giving me, and he's put these principles in place. And the key thing to me in the principles of the treaty, because you have those who say there are no principles to the treaty, The late Maori King said there are no principles to the treaty. The Honourable Winston Peters says there are no principles to the treaty. And they're correct in that the treaty is a very simple document. But the problem is that Acts of Parliament and the judiciary have created principles of the treaty that are very vague, very dangerous, and can mean just about anything that the activists in the judiciary wanted to mean. So you either have the option of deleting them completely, which seems to be a non-starter, that the National Party won't support that anyway, and then the Labour Party will probably just bring them back. So if you get rid of them, Team Basic seems impossible. And so David Seymour's clever trick here is, well, we make the people determine what the principles are. When the people vote for it at a referendum at a constitutional level, then a government is not going to come in and just demolish that because the people have spoken.
Smart politicking, all right. Now, speaking of smart politicking, and before we get on to the next segment of the show, if you're not already a patron of Left Foot Media, go to patreon.com/leftfootmedia. The link is in today's show notes. And become a $5 monthly patron. And if you do, you'll get access to Monday's exclusive part two of this conversation, which is for patrons only. And we're going to be talking in depth about the Harris-Trump, I was going to say Biden, that was a Freudian slip, Harris-Trump debate that happened just yesterday. We're going to be also talking about Trump and the issue of abortion. We're going to be talking about RFK Jr., Russian interference accusations. Basically, it's a big American election special. So if you want to get in on that fascinating conversation, become a patron. Also, I should say now, you can actually check out Patreon content on a trial. We have a weekly trial. You can get a free trial and just check out any of the content. We also now have the option, Patreon is going nuts now, and it must be feeling the competitive pinch because all of a sudden there's these brand new options available, and you can now actually purchase one-off episodes if you want to. If you want to pay far too much, you can pay $6 New Zealand per episode for one-off episodes, or become a $5 monthly patron and get the whole month thrown in for free. But yeah, lots happening over there. Diwa, let's move on, and I want you to tell me about this fascinating story that I saw you actually tweeting about. It was a couple of weeks ago now, wasn't it? But this new compulsory first-year law course at AUT, Auckland University of Technology, Tikanga Māori and the Settler State Legal System of Aotearoa New Zealand. Tell us more about this course and its actual like teaching. What is it actually teaching people?
So this is one of the two compulsory first-year courses if you're doing a law degree at AUT. They already had a similar course about Tikanga Māori, and it seems to have been part of every legal degree in the country. You didn't have to do it, but you could do it.
And it kind of makes sense because, you know, tribal custom and tribal law is, you know, it's part of the legal landscape in New Zealand.
Yes. Yeah, so just a quick, I guess, quick introduction on tikanga is what it means. Basically means custom is how you would apply that in English. And it's a part of English law as well. You had local customs, customary title, customary laws were part of the common law as well. So you could recognize some of those things. And that has some relevance on New Zealand law as well, especially because we've had, say, the foreshore and seabed legislation, which recognized an element of customary title if you could prove, you know, that you actually had that. But what's being done here is that it's being taught as a separate legal system. As you said in the title here, it compares it and contrasts it with the settler state legal system. And unfortunately, this seems to have been put in place by the New Zealand Council of Legal Education, saying that every law course in the country has to include tikanga now in some way. Yeah. But AUT seems to have gone further than anyone else, and they actually teach, if I look, bring up the course outline here, they actually teach that New Zealand has a bidural, bicultural legal system. And a bidural system is one where there are two laws, two sets of different law.
Two rules of law, basically.
And that you need to balance them against each other. But that's not what tikanga means, because it's not a law. It's not a system of law. There was no law in New Zealand.
No.
They didn't have laws. It was tribal customs and tribal leaders. And nobody actually made laws or enforced laws. There were no courts and no judges and no lawyers in New Zealand before a English-style legal system was implemented. So it's completely dishonest and basically teaches lawyers something that's not true. And
so I should say here, it's not even revisionist history. It's a false version of history because, as you say, tikanga is custom, and amongst different Maori tribes, there were different tikanga, different customs, and on some of these questions, they had totally differing views. There was no common law across the whole of the nation.
Correct. Right. Everything just came down to who the tribal ruler used to be, who had power in a particular village, and so on. It was about family, extended families, settling matters between themselves. And if they had to settle matters between different families, you'd do that at the tip of the spear.
Yeah.
And that's how every tribal society in all of history functioned. So I think it's a complete undermining of our British common law inheritance. It's an attack on the Christian foundations of New Zealand as well. I think they really want to bring in some of this pagan stuff. Because Kylie Quince, who many people may know, is the Dean of Law, who complains about everybody being racist and says she wants all these racist dinosaurs to die in a corner, and she's been investigated for that, and then let off, saying, "Oh no, it's fine. She can say that. She can be the Dean of Law and just speak in such
Dewa,
a way."
Dewa, you've already told us, mate. All of your cultures belong to us. We say what we want.
Yeah. And then she speaks very disparagingly of Christianity. And I think I should have listened to that clip again that she made it like a free speech debate, where she's saying, on a free speech is a foreign idea that comes from Christianity, and we need to get rid of it, basically.
So hold on.
And she's teaching this.
So they had a tikanga rule of law, but they hadn't... No guaranteed rights.
No.
Hold on, Connie.
She's very, very open about this. No free speech. No. There's no free speech.
Wow. Okay, then.
That's settler colonialism and oppressive Christianity.
Yeah. Gosh. What are the practical implications, do you think? I mean, obviously, downstream, if you keep teaching this long enough, that this could get pretty serious, right?
Well, that would be my concern, and that's basically it's a war against the legal equality in the system in this country. And so they're trying to manifest this destruction. And that the enemy within the vanguard that they've placed inside all of these institutions, they're basically communists. Some of them will openly say that they're communists. We had a recently a doctor of... I'm not sure what the doctorate was in, but I think she's a lawyer and a doctor, and it was a man, actually. It was a transgender Maori activist. And so they're putting themselves into these positions within the system to try and destroy it from the inside, try and get positions on the judicial bench, and then they can make whatever ruling they want. Where they can, if they're a judge, they can ignore the law, basically, and just hope the attorney general won't fire them, because that has basically never happened. It's never needed to happen. So we'll get into a very serious situation in New Zealand where either the entire legal system becomes unworkable, because you could go to court and then all the lawyers and all the judges are functioning under a different legal system that they've made up amongst themselves.
Yeah, that's astounding. But what I can't get my head around is how the heck you can have something like this that even comes into existence, tertiary qualification that comes into existence that is supposed to be teaching an important discipline, an institutional discipline of the law, and yet they've just created it out of whole cloth. And there's no one, there's no critique, there's no checks and balances in place to say, actually, you can't teach that because that's not true. It's just, it shows you that the gravity of the problem we've actually got in New Zealand, the level of dishonesty, and the absolute wielding of unaccountable power that is going on now.
Absolutely the case. And I just think that the current government is not moving fast enough, really grasping what's going on here. I have spoken with some of the MPs, and they do understand, some of the ones that are in New Zealand First and perhaps in the ACT Party. They understand what's going on, but clearing out New Zealand's bureaucracy, clearing out these institutions, is very, very difficult. So once they get their people inside, there's just not enough time. Like basically, they're hoping that, say, the government lasts one or two terms, and they hunker down slow their advance and try and make sure that they stay put. And then when they get the next radical left-wing government, then they can accelerate again.
Yeah.
Very much functioning on these accelerationist principles.
back to life again after a hibernation period that the awful progressivist bear. Right, what should, or how do you think we should respond to this, I guess, in a sense? Like, what would you say if someone said, oh, come on, this is just, you know, more of the same unhelpful modern university activism, D-words, you know, it's just par for the course now, mate, isn't it?
One of the things that seems to happen is the level of the qualification from AUT is considered to be of a lower quality than the other law schools because of this. So that's somewhat of a positive sign, again, you know, for employers to view this as a very negative thing. The other option, of course, is to have our people still study law. Obviously, it's easy for you to still go and get a degree, and you don't, you know, you deal with these problems as you come across them. It's been like that for a long, long time. So don't want to actually discourage our people from going into law. I would, in fact, encourage them. So I would just say to people, one of the good ways to counter this is you go and study law. If you want to encourage your children to go and study law, perhaps if you're in that situation, and make sure that we have our lawyers, good lawyers in place. And then the other side of the equation is really a political solution, is that you need to be able to clear these people out somehow. The counter-revolution, I would call it. And so we need to be thinking a little bit about counter-revolutionary principles and how you clear these people out one way or another through political power.
We're going to talk now about an issue in the States. We're going to end, and we are going to stick to time. I'm looking at this countdown clock in front of me. We are going to stick to time definitely today, but we've got two issues we want to cover in this free-to-air episode. There's been a lot of talk about the actual state of immigration and what's been going on in America, and have they lost control and what's actually happening. We'll talk more about that in relation to the debate in the next episode. But I thought this story, which as far as I can tell has been woefully underreported, and I'm not surprised, was worthy of our conversation because we want our listeners to be well informed. Colorado mayor admits police have lost control of part of their community to a Venezuelan illegal migrant gang. I think they're called Tren de Aragua. I think that's how you might say that. Let me read from this article. In California, roaming groups of military-aged illegal migrants have been caught trying to take control of school buses full of children. Parents of the children formed defensive perimeters to block the takeover, but the school districts are warning parents to be on alert. There's also the story about an apartment building, the Aurora Police Department established a special task force in collaboration with other local, state, and federal partners to specifically address concerns about this Venezuelan gang and other criminal activity affecting migrant communities. And apparently what they've done is they've appeared to have taken over a whole block. It's quite astounding. I mean, this is just, yeah. So on the one hand, you get these people saying, no, there's no problem here. No issue at all. This is all lies and all fabrication. And here you have, I mean, it's sort of reminiscent of Judge Dredd or something. they've just taken over a city, a multi-rise apartment building.
You've forgotten to mention the Haitians eating cats in Ohio.
Oh, we're going to talk about that in the next. We're going to talk about that in the next episode. All right.
Great. But so, what the entire Harris campaign at this point is resting on the hope that Venezuelan gangs aren't going to be taking over apartment complexes in cities across the Midwest.
Yeah.
That you're not going to have roaming gangs of Mexican cartels hijacking school buses. That you're not going to, you know, if the Haitians aren't going to go and eat more cats or kill more ducks in the ponds, or what's actually worse, which is, you know, sadly the thing that gets people talking about it is the household pets and the ducks, but it's the murders that are taking place in many of these cities. Getting to the point now where they get these parents to come up on stage and do press conferences and say, and they had a father saying, I wish my son had been killed by a white man, because then people wouldn't be racist and so on.
Like, it's just diabolical, right? It's satanic to have that happening.
And the entire Harris campaign is basically banking itself on these stories not escalating or carrying on in the next 2 months. And for Donald Trump, this is the election, and I'm sure I said this last time, but if I didn't, I'll say it now. It's an election about immigration.
Yeah.
And for Trump, it's about immigration. It's why he won in 2016. It's why he's going to win next month, because of immigration. That's the only thing that really matters from his perspective, from his angle, and he's probably pretty happy with that. It's immigration, and things are falling apart after 4 years of Biden-Harris open borders. Things are getting diabolically bad.
Yeah. And I think we'll talk more about the debate in the next episode, folks. We got lots to say about that. But one thing I do think was a bit of an underrated moment actually last night for Trump was when he talked about, okay, well, I'm prepared to cut this debate short. Let's go right now down to Washington because you have the power, Kamala, to sign and take, you know, you can sign an executive order to actually tighten the borders right now. And I'm willing to cut this debate short to go with you to do that. And it was very interesting how quickly the moderators, who were absolutely in their pocket, we'll talk more about that in the second episode, they didn't want to have a bar of that. But yeah, it is a mess. And there are real victims to this. And there are very serious long-term consequences. And what's happening at the moment is the Democrats, they have up until now, I think, haven't they? They've really played on and exploited genuine Christian compassion. But what's happening now is a lot more people are realizing that Christianity was never mindless compassion. It always had a compassionate common good. So you balanced the welcoming of the stranger against the realities of, if you are unthinking and irrational in opening up your borders and all the rest of it, you will destroy the common good in your society, and then you won't have any society to welcome people into. So you know it's like having a home, right? You welcome strangers in, but you don't let them come in any other day or night with an open door.
No, and these are Christian principles of well-ordered loves. See this in the New Testament as well, with the Apostle Paul saying that, you know, if you don't look after those of the house of faith, you don't look after those in your own household and by extension therefore in your land, then you're worse than an unbeliever, worse than an infidel. Yeah. Because you are not looking after the people that God has put you there to look after first. These countries need to be fixed, and you can fix them. It's not that hard to fix them. They need a well-ordered right-wing government to fix it in the way that Nayib Bukele has done so in El Salvador. I mean, it took him a few years, and he turned El Salvador around, and he offered to do the same to Haiti. Undoubtedly, the same could be done in Venezuela and where these other people are coming from. It could be done in Mexico. But nobody wants to actually solve these problems. But we've seen very clearly from the example of Bukele that these things can be fixed very, very quickly.
Let's finish now by, let's wade our way out of those controversial waters before we get too right-wing utopian. And let's
talk a utopia, okay?
It's a well-functioning
society. It doesn't need to be a utopia.
No, but I have a sneaking suspicion that certain fixes have involved shifting their problems over to more liberal Western nations who haven't been as discerning. But that's a whole nother story. Let's finish by talking about Waltz and Harris. I'm putting them in that order in the CNN interview. Holy moly, man. We'll talk about the debate in the next episode, but they did that interview. It's almost forgotten now, wasn't it, that Harris and Waltz turned out to finally do an interview. And first of all, they've been hiding for weeks, Dewa, and then they came out of Osama bin Laden finally came out of the cave to go on CNN.
Yes, and for 12 minutes or something, pre-recorded, pre-edited interview on CNN. Two of them together, and you compare this to Trump and Vance, who are running around the country and speaking for hours on end, even if it's mumbling and rambling, whatever Trump feels like doing. He'll talk for hours about anything, and the media are really running Harris's campaign. Right? And I have to tie this back to the debate. I don't want to do too much of that since we're going to talk about that later, but it's a media campaign. It's not a Harris campaign. She's not in the campaign. She's done a 12 minutes of total press interviews since she became the nominee.
It's quite crazy.
And I think she plans to keep it that way. Like, that's her path to victory is the less that people see of her, the more the media do to prop her up. And the media understand that as well.
Yeah.
They understand their job to do this, and they're doing it as best as they can. There's no other way to put this. She came out all right on the debate, I think, in terms of that was positive. But yeah, that people forgot about that interview that she did. That one interview she did, it was gone in 5 minutes flat.
Well, they memory holed it, I think, because, I mean, if Trump had had something like that, they would have been tearing it to bits still. But they memory holed it. But it still didn't look great. And ironically, they made the problem worse for themselves by just hiding away for so long. Was it 40 days or something by the time before they made an appearance? And so everyone was now fixated on the interview. If they hadn't been hiding, it would have been just another interview. And then they get into this weird sort of situation where she's with Waltz in a way that made it look like she can't do interviews without her safety animal. you know, Tim Waltz beside her. And then on top of that, the lighting was weird and her seat or her seating, I don't know whether it was just odd. She looked, someone said she looked like an Oompa Loompa and I thought they were just being unfair and cruel. And I watched and I was like, she really does look like she's really, really like a little person alongside Tim Waltz. So whatever seat she was sitting on, I mean, I don't know. It was just the whole thing. It felt like maybe an interview that you'd give in the final days before an empire goes into a dystopian state of ruin or something, you know, some darkened room. It was all, it wasn't a great look.
Yeah, the whole situation there, as well with the answers that she gave and the journalist as well with like the paper, that she's like kind of like, here's the answers on the piece of paper, and I like giving her multi choice questions as well, and even then her answers were nonsensical, and it's been like that with everything, every pre-rehearsed, even the pre-rehearsed questions that she gets, and she. You know, tries to give the answers that she's memorized, and as soon as she has to say anything beyond that, it turns into complete gobbledygook.
It's bizarre. All right. And we're going to talk more about that in the next episode, folks. We're going to be discussing, and probably in great detail, I'd imagine, too, in the next episode, the actual debate that happened yesterday. Lots to talk about there. We are going to also talk about Trump, who had been shilling for abortion, but then sort of decided to change tact quite radically all of a sudden again. RFK Jr. joining Trump. And, of course, the latest accusations. I thought this old tired hoax was dead. But no, we've got a bit more rigor mortis left in this corpse. So we're back to Russian interference. You know, they brought out Ivan the Terrible again and plugged him in, charged up the generator, and his dead corpse is dancing around again. So we'll talk about all of that. Diwa, where can people follow you in the meantime?
My RCR show has changed to Monday afternoon, so 12 o'clock Monday.
Good slot.
So this won't be on Friday anymore. Usually you tune in on Friday if you're listening to this on Friday on Left Foot Media. But Monday, midday to 2 p.m. And been having some great shows recently. Been talking about West Africa, mercenaries, Wagner, Russian mercenaries, Ukrainian special forces fighting each other in West Africa. I've spoken with the chairman of the AfD, German right-wing party, Alternative for Deutschland, and about their recent victory, especially young people, a lot of focus on young people turning to the right in some of these elections, and even in New Zealand polls. So good positive message for why young people are becoming more right-wing. And my columns are on goodoil.news every Saturday morning. And, of course, I do these with you once a month, and you can go to rightminds.nz to find the archives. And I'm on X, I'm on Telegram, and come and chat with me.
Do check out Diwa's work, folks. He's been putting out some great stuff. I really love some of those RCR interviews, and I don't just say that because I've been on there. But there've been some really – it's really interesting, and you're hearing – in New Zealand, interviews with people that the mainstream media just wouldn't go near, and so you don't get a full sort of appreciation for particularly overseas what's happening. So it's really great stuff. Don't forget, too, if you want to hear Diwa and his thoughts about the debate and all the other stuff we're going to be talking about in the next episode on Monday, then go to patreon.com/leftfootmedia and become a $5 monthly patron. If you're thinking, oh, Brendan, I don't know if I could part ways with my hard-earned pesos, then you can try a free weekly trial. Check out all the content for a week and see what you think. We're actually going to have a month coming up soon where we're going to make everything free for a month so you can check out all the fresh content free and see whether you like it or not. But lots of people are engaging and finding it enjoyable, so why not join the momentum for something that is good, true, and beautiful. With that all said, the link for that, by the way, is in today's show notes. That's patreon.com/leftfootmedia. Diwa, we're going to sign off now and we're going to go behind the paywall. If you're not a Patreon, then you need to leave now.
And I should just add to this, to that, Brendan, I've seen you mentioned several times now by the so-called anti-fascists, the left-wing extremists who are keeping a very close eye on what, you know, good right-wing people are doing, and they're mentioning you more often. So whatever it is you're doing, keep doing.
That's all the best people are tuning in. If you're listening, hey, we love you. Oh, it's good to be noticed, isn't it? It's nice to be liked. Alrighty, folks, we'll see you next time on Dispatches with Diwa. Patrons, we'll see you Monday. When I was young, my daddy said, gotta keep one eye open in your
Yeah.